Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The right to work issue is one that remains a subject of debate in our area and in other parts of the country, and we'll be talking about it just a little bit later in the program. But first, one of the giants in American labor history. I'm talking about Mary Harris Jones, better known as Mother Jones. She has been called the grandmother of agitators. She lived for 100 years and had tremendous impact on the American worker movement, including child labor. Her work for Southern Illinois miners is legendary. She is buried near Mount Olive, Illinois, to be near her boys, as she put it. That's where a museum honoring her work is located, and there's a major monument there in her honor. So, as Labor Day approaches, we'll be talking about this important and influential woman with Rosemary Foyer. She's associate professor with the Department of History at Northern Illinois University. She's also on the board of the Mother Jones Museum, and she's director of the Mother Jones Heritage Project. She joins us from WNIJ in DeKalb, Illinois. Rosemary, so nice to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
You know, I was speaking to someone this morning, and I said, do you know who Mother Jones is? And the answer was, yes, it's a news magazine. I just wonder why Mother Jones, the woman, has been seemingly forgotten in so many quarters.
Well, when Mother Jones magazine was began publishing in the 1970s, they wanted to take her name, so she wasn't completely forgotten. A revival of her name began in the 1970s. Out of the social movements of that era, and I think that's appropriate. I think that magazine has largely forgotten her and forgotten the real history and the connection between economic rights and social justice in general. And so the labor movement, I think, is also, complicit in forgetting her, in part because she became somewhat of a persona non grata in the mid-20th century. But there have been groups of people, and especially in Mount Olive, Illinois, in that region, who've done their part in trying to keep her memory alive. The Mother Jones Foundation, since the 1980s, has had a regular ceremony. Another one is coming up in October, October 11th. So in Illinois, she was never forgotten, I would say. But new generations of people largely forget most of the rich history of the labor movement. And as a labor historian, I'm determined to do something about that.
We'll get to her full story in just a moment, but why was she considered persona non grata in the middle of the 20th century?
She was a small-D Democrat, an agitator, and a socialist. And the United Mine Workers, the head of the United Mine Workers was John L. Lewis, who was an autocrat, an anti-Democrat. He organized and should be credited with organizing large numbers of miners, or at least gaining some benefits for them. But he was not a firm believer in democracy. And that union became somewhat corrupted in the mid-20th century. A whole movement for social justice had to be built to bring it back into the democratic realm, frankly. That happened in the 1970s, and that coincides also with some of the rejuvenation of her memory.
Yeah, I remember John L. Lewis and that he carried some baggage. I also remember those tremendous eyebrows.
Yes.
But that's another story.
He believed in mobilization. He did not think that workers should run the movement, and Mother Jones did. She sort of traversed leadership and democratic rule, so she wasn't against having leaders, but she really did. She despised Lewis, and he responded by eliminating her from the memory of the union.
Well, let's revive our memory of Mother Jones and go back to the beginning. She was born in Ireland, of course, but she really got off to a very rough start, didn't she?
Yeah, she was born in Cork, and that's a very important place. I'm really happy to report that Cork has finally remembered her, and in fact, they have a festival there. They had forgotten her as well. But the reason that Cork is important is because it was a port city, and it was a rich city in many ways. But during the Great Hunger, a lot of products were brought to Cork for transport to England and other places. While people were starving, bodies were being dragged off in carts in the streets, and here people were starving. So that was her first lesson in class injustice, and she commented on that. She would, death carts would be an ever-present bitter memory of hers.
And so, how, go ahead. I'm sorry.
If you do, you want me to tell the rest of her?
Yes, well, please do.
Brief history.
Yeah.
Okay. So she is one of the people who, with her family, came to Canada and to the Americas. Many Irish, of course, from the, what's called the Great Hunger, crossed the seas, and that was another bitter experience. But things seemed to be getting better for her. Her family moved to Toronto. And in Toronto, they were part of a vibrant Irish immigrant working class community. She said she got her first experiences in strikes with her father in the Grand Trunk Railroad strikes of the 1850s. And then she became a teacher. So she became educated and a very smart woman. She was known as a quick wit and a great debater in school. So she was promoted. She was promoted to the normal school, which is the secular school. And she became a teacher. She moved to Monroe, Michigan. And she wasn't exactly satisfied with teaching by the norms of the day. So she went on to Chicago, part of, a vibrant Irish working class community there. And things, she became a garment worker there. Things seemed to be okay. The Civil War hit. She went to Memphis. She got married. She had four children. And then in the midst of, or just after the war, in the midst of Reconstruction, the great yellow fever epidemic hit Memphis. And she and her children and her husband, George Jones, who was an active trade unionist, faced that. And unfortunately, all four of her children and her husband died in that. She looked at that as class injustice, too. As she wrote later in her autobiography, the rich and the well-to-do fled the city, and the working class were left to experience this death, the death carts again in the city. So she said, no one came to us. No one could. Everybody was experiencing this terrible tragedy. So she could have just faced a life of bitterness. She moved to Chicago instead and became an observer of the class injustice in Chicago. So she had a sister in Chicago, and we presume that she went to live there with her after her family. She lost her family. But there she sewed for the very rich, and this was the era of great, great inequality of wealth, the growth of huge fortunes in the midst of terrible conditions. She sewed for people in the city who were the very rich and experienced how they treated the poor and the immigrants. And she felt her own passions about that issue happening. She then experienced, she was getting her dress shop organized and it was doing well. And then the Great Fire in Chicago hit. So she lost everything again. She was homeless on the streets. She was in a church at night. She started listening to some speakers. There were some radical speakers in Chicago who taught her, she said, about the role of class. And so from the experience of class injustice, she started to experience the idea of fighting back against it in another way, not through her husband's union, but through unemployed organizing. So she got involved in that. And for the rest of her life, she would continue to be involved in that.
How did she achieve the kind of prominence she did? It was an eventual happening, of course, but after all, she was a woman, and women did not have or enjoy very many leadership roles in that era.
Well, they did in some respects. In the unemployed movement, there were some women. There were women contingents. We forget that women were wage workers, and so she was one of them. She had to provide for herself. And so I think she became involved in various struggles after 1871, after that Great Fire experience, in the populist movement, which she became involved in. This is a movement that begins in 1893. There's huge unemployment numbers in the midst of great affluence. The rich and the well-to-do were very, very, were doing very well. And, you know, she basically took to the streets. And that's really, she was learning as a global citizen too. In fact, one of her first speeches that I have is she said, I'm a citizen of the world. She came from Ireland and she thought about class injustice in respect to a global movement. And so she learned from that. She learned from the Paris Commune, where workers took over and took control of factories and produced their own commune. She looked to 1877 and the general strike, which had a major role in St. Louis. So she looked to those kinds of examples of street justice, and she began to shape it. So the populist movement, a lot of farm women were involved, and in the unemployed movement, they were also involved in that. So she really doesn't come into prominence until 1897. And that has something to do with St. Louis. She calls for a general strike in a speech in Pittsburgh in 1897 on behalf of a living wage. The United Mine Workers had gone on strike, and it was joined by movements across the country, including Southern Illinois. In fact, it had been catalyzed by a miner in Mount Olive in Southern Illinois, General Alexander Bradley. So she is known as a radical, and she's trying to organize for a living wage for all workers, not only miners, and she wants to have a catalyst. Her speeches were just so powerful. This was the age of great speeches and great rhetorical flourish, but she had a way of communicating complex ideas to a working class audience. The audience in Pittsburgh in 1897, when she actually started her speech by saying, fellow slaves, fellow working class slaves, I come to you to speak about a new day that's dawning. So she gave them the encouragement and the inspiration to do their own organizing, to self-organize.
Well, when did she get the title, the Grandmother of Agitators? At about this time?
No, that was much later. She got the title of Mother Jones through a variety of factors. One was that she tried to save a worker's life. He had been railroaded in a major strike, the Pullman strike, into jail and accused of killing four people. And she took on the role of mother of saving his life. She actually just went to the White House and demanded that the president listen to the facts of the case. And another way, she advocated against child labor, and the children of the factories started calling her Mother Jones. And so those two things combined, so that by 1896, 1897, a lot of people were calling her that, but it really stuck after 1898 when she really did she was part of a movement that helped to save this man's life. And then the name stuck. She also used that term mother to soften some of her radical demands. So how can you object to an elderly woman saying some of these radical things? And that's the way she used that to promote the very radical ideas. The idea of the grandmother of all agitators came when she went before many Senate committee hearings, and one who really didn't like her too much. One senator said, "We know that you're called the most grandmother of all agitators," and she just calmly replied, "I'd like to one day be known as the great grandmother of all agitators."
What a wonderful woman she sounds like. We wish there were a few of them around today, perhaps. And some of the issues that she was concerned about persist even to this day, needless to say. We have to take a break, Rosemary Foer. We'll do that. We'll come back. We're talking about Mother Jones, who was one of the early leaders of the American labor movement, as I'm sure you've evaluated that part of it in our discussion so far. We'll come back with more in just a moment. We have a number of folks who are starting to call. They'd like to get into the conversation. We'll bring them in as well. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Rosemary Foer, associate professor with the Department of History at Northern Illinois University. And we're talking about Mother Jones, one of the very early leaders of the American worker movement. Rosemary, there's no way, of course, that we could know this, but it's interesting to just speculate as to what she might be thinking today with all the talk about the 1% And she had her own 1%, I guess, that she was concerned about in her day. And the American labor movement is in a state of some decline at this time. I wonder how she would be viewing all of this.
Well, she would be viewing it the same way she did then, which is you have to take to the streets, you have to take mass action. She would argue that the labor movement has been too tame. I'm sure she would say, what's wrong with you? You don't make compromises, but you have to strike. She saw, and I think this is an important thing that we've lost, because strikes have become, I guess, viewed as impossible to win, number one, and almost, spitting in your own soup, that you're going to just do damage to yourself. And she would say that striking is a human right, and that having the power to act collectively is a human right. And I think that's so radical for our times, even. People just do not think of that. So she would be definitely more radical than most people could handle today. And she would say as well, don't get embedded, I think, in party politics. Your power comes from collective action, from mass action. So I think that she saw, it wasn't that she derided politics, but she just saw it was an adjunct to mass action.
Let's go back just a little bit and talk about her involvement with the Southern Illinois miners, because that's where you have a great interest, and of course there's a great interest in that amongst our listening audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of her claims to fame historically is that she took what the miners and these traditions in working class communities, which is the Great Marches. In Southern Illinois, they did that, and it was a tradition that came from a global heritage, really. The Chartist who came and formed the first Miners Association, the American Miners Association, marched from mine to mine to get their brothers to come out and to agree that we want, a 10-hour day, or we want the right to be paid correctly, not to have our wages stolen from us. So these issues of a living wage, of the wage theft that are still with us today, they used mass action marches. And Mother Jones, these were thought of as so criminal and such a conspiracy that they were put down with troops. So one of the things that she did is take that, and people across the 19th and early 20th century took that kind of action and made it into a collective action that wasn't as scary. They brought families together. So one of the things that she did was organize children. She led children in the parades, made them into parades and into a kind of theater of collective action that wasn't as scary to the middle class as people. These were just as scary and unacceptable to the 1%, believe me. But at the time, that's what she did. And so she was a brilliant organizer in that way.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I was just saying that this was something that was a treasure and a kind of collective action from the heritage of Southern Illinois miners. She also thought that the Southern Illinois miners had used that in 1897 and beyond to make Illinois the best labor state in the nation. She said that explicitly, and she said we have to take our power. They had a lot of power, the United Mine Workers did in Illinois. And so she said that's a model for us. Take no, don't slow down. Don't go a slow road, but rather take action to win your rights.
What kind of success did she have beyond this? I mean, obviously that's a great success in and of itself, but in terms of winning better wages and better conditions for these workers, what could we point to show that side of the success?
Well, she was somebody who brought about congressional investigations, and that meant significant awareness. You know, it's just like today, though. A lot of these congressional investigations lead to tepid legislation or, some degree of legislation. But really, the legacy had to do with the 1930s. And the way that people had that memory of workers' rights and the memory of Mother Jones was really brought to bear in the 1930s. You know, that was the remnants of her legacy. So she wouldn't think that. Certainly she brought awareness to the issue of child labor, and we did get some child labor laws, but it was this kind of spirit thread of history, a kind of legacy of action that is her main claim to fame, I think. Yeah. Because a lot of that legislation was overturned in the 1920s. You know, you've got a little bit of progress and there was a step back.
I want to take a couple of calls, but first I'd like to point out, too, because I think this is important, of her involving African-Americans and immigrants as part of her movement, which certainly increased the numbers, therefore, of the people she was representing and their clout.
Absolutely. And that's another parallel to the present that we are – I think the labor movement is doing much better on that score, but things like the fight for 15. She was one of the people in the labor movement. She started out, like many, as fearing immigrants, and her experience was these are the best union fighters. African Americans were the best union fighters. And she started this claim that we have to unite in order to have true collective action. We can't reject the immigrants and the African Americans in our midst. And she truly believed that they would be the best and strongest trade unionists. And that's the case today. You know, there's a parallel. The people who voice the strongest views on unions are African Americans and immigrants.
You know, this may be a little bit off the wall, but given the fact that you know, civil disobedience was one of her tactics, and given the fact that she was so heavily involved with African Americans, and reading about her, I was wondering if Martin Luther King might possibly have been inspired by her somehow.
I don't know that I have any evidence of that, but one of the things we have to recognize is there are a long trail and train of evidence of working class movements using civil disobedience. There's so much of it, and we have to trace it a little bit better. And so it's in the air, and it's in the streets. I think there's a long memory of that. People who were involved in the movement with Martin Luther King had that experience in the labor movement as well. So from the earliest days, he was active in labor circles and certainly would have heard of her and known about her.
Yeah, a number of early civil rights leaders were involved in labor. I think of people like A. Philip Randolph, for instance, just one name that comes to mind.
Absolutely. And she would have been somebody that A. Philip Randolph knew.
Yeah. Let's take a couple of calls, Rosemary. If you're ready, I think our listeners are as well. We'll start with Andrew, who's calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hi there. I wanted to ask a question. My great-grandfather was a man named Barney Cohen, and he was, I believe it was the first Secretary of Labor for the state of Illinois. And I want to know if perhaps the name means anything and if he ever crossed paths with Mother Jones, to your knowledge.
Mother Jones' path was crossed by many. So she crossed many paths. And so I think that it's possible. I don't know specifics about that. We're tracing her. One of the things we're doing is mapping her, and it is an astonishing map. We just have a fraction of it on the Mother Jones Museum website. It's motherjonesmuseum.org. So if you send me, go there, and I will look up and see if there's any possibility. We have thousands of articles on her. She is front page news in every newspaper across the country. This is a woman who has been really underrepresented in the history books compared to where she was at this time 100 years ago. She's probably the most prominent person. She's known. When newspapers discuss her, they say, of course, everybody knows who she is. Yet, you know, more people know about Jane Addams and more, I guess, reformist and elite figures than they do Mother Jones now. But that isn't representative of where she was later or earlier. Sorry.
You know, it's interesting. I Googled women advocates, famous women advocates this morning, and there are a number of lists, and she is not on most of them.
Yeah, that's why we have this job to do. And the museum will certainly help with that.
You know, one of the things we need to point out is the role that, with regard to Southern Illinois miners, the role that Belleville, right across the river from us here, played in that whole movement.
Absolutely. They were the base for the American Miners Association. Those miners, this was during the Civil War period, and they are the ones that formed. It was a very it was a mining area. People forget that this is where mining took place, right across the river. And it also took place in Missouri. She was very well known throughout Missouri. She spoke there. She spoke in St. Louis often. And, I mean, it was thousands and thousands of people would come to hear her at various locations.
Here, this part of the country,
yes.
Around the rest of the country, and in other parts of the world.
Right. Well, she was in Canada and Mexico. She was one of the foremost advocates of the Mexican Revolution. She met with the revolutionaries. She tried to keep Taft in line. And in fact, when the revolution finally succeeded, they brought her there and said, well, if you want to live here in a villa, we'll support you for the rest of your life to do that. That's how important she was in that campaign. So that all came out of labor organizing and cross-border organizing. She had no boundaries as far as citizenship. She thought working-class people should unite across all national boundaries.
Before I go back to the phones, I just want to just cite one other quote that's attributed to her. And she said very simply, I'm no angel.
Right. She was called the miner's angel, but she, in one speech, said, I don't think we should focus on angels. There are probably very few in the afterlife, if there is an afterlife, and we should focus on the here and now. And so she embraced the idea of militancy, including for women. And that's where she also connected with the Belleville women and with women in Southern Illinois. She encouraged them to take to the streets to self-organize. In her first speech, she said, women organize separately from the men. Have your own organizations and do your own thing. You can defy the bayonets and the troops, because she hoped that the troops wouldn't shoot the women. Well, we found out that that wasn't exactly true. But Mother Jones herself escaped the bayonet, I think, in part because of that.
Well, I think the establishment probably thought she was a real pain in the neck, don't you think?
Well, they did. Yeah. And she was called the chief tormentor of John D. Rockefeller, who was the leading mogul. He'd be like the Koch brothers of the day. She just took to wherever he was going and followed him around and gave speeches. And he had to be in hiding, in part because of her and the broader campaign against him after the Colorado Coalfield War, when 11 children and 2 women were killed by his mercenaries. They were armed troops that were paid for by essentially Rockefeller and his minions. So it was a era of conflict. It's hard to convey. There used to be this thing called the consensus in American history. Well, if you study history, you realize there was no consensus and people fought back. I call this the era of the great refusal, working class people rising up and saying in a collective response, no, we will not agree.
We're really talking about several eras, aren't we? Because we're talking about the latter part of the 19th century, right up through 1930 when she died. And we're talking the Rockefellers and the Civil War. So there's an extensive period of time in which she was active.
Actually, yes.
Let me take some more calls. We'll bring in Sheila calling from St. Louis. Sheila, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for having this program. I've been teaching my children and grandchildren about Mother Jones for about 30 years now. And I thought, if it wasn't for unions, I'm a Screen Actors Guild member since 1975, and I know I would have never gotten my residuals if it weren't for my union. But I'd like to inspire us. One of the most inspiring stories about Mother Jones was that little children were losing their fingers in the textile mills. Apparently, from what I read, the owners of the textile mills were hiring families so that they could have these little children who would sleep under the machines, the textile machines.
Yes.
And then
the
children would thread the needles and lose their fingers, and often lose their fingers, and they weren't going to school. And if it was not for Mother Jones, you know, that wouldn't have been ended. And she was very courageous. She had her life threatened many times. And I think it's one of the parts of her legacy that would be really wonderful is if we could start having roundtable debates and discussions. I think that's one of the things that's lacking in our world today on all levels, in all areas of our lives. We need to debate and have roundtable discussions. And, of course, honor this incredible woman. So courageous. Did you read the stories about the children with their fingers?
Oh, absolutely. It is an amazing story. There are so many stories we haven't heard. There are so many, gaps in our understanding and our history.
Were there any threats against her life?
Oh, absolutely, yes. When she was in West Virginia, for instance, in 1901 and 1902, hotels were burned down in an attempt to burn her out. There was a real system of terror that is also not in our history books. This was a country in which the 1% of its day really fought back with hired mercenaries and troops, with agents provocateur. It is a hidden history, and she was inspiring people to be brave enough, and she inspired children. Her style of organizing was not to get only laws, but to organize the children. And I'll tell you just another story of a mill in New Jersey. The children there heard about Mother Jones, and they went on strike against the kind of conditions the caller, Sheila, mentioned. Worse, like they had to run 25 miles a day to keep up with the mill and the textile practice there. And so they had caustic, their fingernails were so brittle that they would break and split. And so the children there organized in the name of Mother Jones. They found the Mother Jones in themselves, in other words. They expected her to come. They said, we hear that when Mother Jones comes to a strike, the people win. So I think that's a story where you see her inspiration going, even where she's not. She never came to see those children, but they rose up and they won through a strike. Here are 9-year-olds. That was what the reporter said. 9 to 12-year-olds going on strike in their mill, and they made velvet. So this is, the kinds of stories that we're recovering. And I think Sheila's right. One of the things we want to do in the museum and at the sites is to have performance, have people talking to each other, and also performing the words from the past. So we're very excited to think about a project that will bring this history to life. We aren't going to be a traditional museum where you see things on the wall. We want to have people like Sheila contact us and, join us in remembering this history and reliving it.
Why don't you tell us the story about her decision? I alluded to it in the introduction, the story about her insistence on being buried in Mount Olive.
Well, this has a long history, really. She came to visit every time she came to Illinois, because Illinois was well organized by the 19-teens, at least the miners were. And it was the strongest labor state in the country. She didn't organize here as much, but whenever she traveled through by train, she would stop in Springfield and in Mount Olive, and she would visit the Martyrs Monument there. This was the monument where workers had given their lives in Verdon, Illinois, which is a town close by. By standing on the train tracks and confronting Chicago guards who were bringing in strike breakers from the South. And they were also confronting teal detective agents who were armed with Winchesters. And they were said they were willing to sacrifice their lives for the Union. There was a racial conflict involved in it as well, but I will say that the miners there were really trying to confront these teal guards. They were not aiming at African-American strikebreakers who were brought up. And the African-American strikebreakers were not coming there to break the strike. They weren't even knowledgeable that it was, or they didn't even know there was a strike on. At any rate, four workers from Mount Olive were killed and many other wounded in that event, and also some teal guards and Chicago policemen were also wounded, or were also killed. And there was a monument that was built, and that monument had a tradition of commemoration that came about from 1898, when this event happened, all the way through the 19-teens. She came and spoke there, and she said in 1920s that she wanted to be buried there to honor the men. It was a tradition of memory, really, that she was about in doing this. It was, there were many, many other monuments to the dead across the country. But she thought that this spirit of commemoration was worthwhile, putting herself into the ground with these men, as she said.
I'm going to take one more call. That's all time will allow. We'll bring in Susan, calling from Illinois. Susan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. What a great program. I just wanted to mention that Madison County, Glen Carbon, the symbol for Glen Carbon is a man in a miner's helmet. And we have subsidence all over the place. We have to watch out for subsidence. There have been mines all over the place here.
Susan, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Rosemary, if you want to respond
yes.
to that.
Well, I actually grew up in Freeburg, Illinois, and our house had to be moved twice because of subsidence. So I think that's the remnants, and I think that Mother Jones would say, you know, why are you letting this happen? You know, why did we let this happen? She thought the mine should be controlled by the people. She believed that all the resources of the earth should be controlled by the people and not a few men. She called them pirates, not a few corporate pirates.
And they called her a Bolshevik for that, correct?
Yeah. Well, she actually said that she believed in Bolshevism if it meant democratic rule by the people. And that's how it was meant at the time that the Russian Revolution happened. She said Bolshevik means, in translation, democracy. So she really believed that. It in that respect. She was, again, a small-D Democrat, not somebody who believed the state should control everything. She believed that workers should own everything. They should own their jobs, they should own themselves, and they should own this country.
I have a note here.
Or at least run the country.
I have a note here asking if Glen Carbon is called Glen Carbon because of the mines.
Absolutely, yeah. It was a company town. When miners marched through that in 1897 in the strike for the miners' wage, the reporters commented on how poor the miners were. It was the most impoverished little town you can imagine. So they gave their lives for mining, and then I think we're suffering now the consequences of that mining. These areas really, truly deserve reparation. They were, if you look at it in a global sense, they were the outpost and the areas that were exploited for the large cities to rise. And now they have no jobs because of the end of coal mining, or their jobs in coal mining have been lost. And, you know, we need to do something to rejuvenate that area.
We'll have to end it on that note. Rosemary Foyer, this has been a fascinating discussion. I'm sure glad we were able to get together, and I think members of the audience are too, as they've indicated in some of their comments on the phones. But thank you so much. It's a fascinating story, and hopefully more people now will want to learn more about it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
That's Rosemary Foyer, Associate Professor with the Department of History at Northern Illinois University. We've been talking about Mother Jones. When we come back, St. Louis Public Radio's Joe Manis will join us to talk about a big issue confronting today's American labor scene. That's the right to work. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.